Okay, it's now time to plan for your future. I am joined now with Jason Betts, an independent private wealth advisor with Ameriprise Financial. He and his team actually manage $350 million in client assets. Their mission is to provide clients with a deep-rooted confidence that their unique financial and personal goals are understood and valued. So I know I don't have much time with you, Jason. I'm going to thank you so much for calling in today. So let's get right to it. So Jason, why is behavioral finance something investors should understand?
Well, first off, I think as investors, we get inundated with information and misinformation and solicitations, and this can all create a desire to kind of quote unquote beat the market, and we can emotionally feel compelled to buy or sell at certain times in order to do that. The unfortunate fact behind this is that there's going to be times where emotions can affect our behavior and our decision making in a big way. Now, don't get me wrong, there are certain areas of our life where our emotions are obviously super helpful. But in our financial affairs, our emotions are generally not very helpful. They can sacrifice accuracy for speed. Our emotions, they want us to respond quickly, and they're often wrong. Generally, the worst time to make an important decision, especially financial decision, is when we're feeling overly emotional. So let me give you an example. And I gave this example in a previous talk, but I really think it's helpful to help put things in perspective in terms of investor objectives compared to investor results. So Dalbar does a study every year. What they do is they actually look at the rate of return of the S&P 500 over the last 10 years, 20 years, and 30 years. And then they audit individual investors. They audit their investment activity and investment returns. And so the 2020 study's not out yet, but then at the end of 2019, here were the results. The S&P 500 over the last 30 years had an annual rate of return of 9.96%. Over that same time period, the average stock investor averaged a rate of return of 5.1%. Huge difference, right? There is only one major reason for that disparity in rates of return, and that reason is poor investor behavior. So the behavior in this case is making decisions to buy and sell investments at times that were, in hindsight, not very good times. So as investors, especially experienced investors, we like to think of ourselves as unemotional or detached from our investments. And the reality is that can be very challenging. So most folks agree and, you know, kind of understand certain investment principles. And I'll just give a few as an example. One would be owning stocks has historically earned a very good rate of return over the long term. Second would be buy, hold, and rebalance strategies are typically more successful than busy trading strategies where we're trying to time the market. Third would be that diversification can help us manage our desire for profit while simultaneously managing our fear of large losses. And then a fourth would be we want to buy low and sell high as investors, right? So most folks agree with these principles and believe in them. But unfortunately, oftentimes we actually don't stick with those principles when fear or fear of missing out or other uncertainty comes into the picture.
So why do you think investors don't stick with these principles when that kind of uncertainty comes into the picture?
I think there's several reasons. Let me start with a little bit on how our brains work. So there's a part of our brain called the amygdala. Some folks have heard of it. It rules our emotional decision making. It's also our natural fight or flight response. So it's served us over thousands of years as a survival mechanism for life-threatening situations. When you see a dangerous wild animal, the amygdala is going to help you decide to get away quick, right? But the thing is, when we're faced with virtually any form of trouble or stress, the amygdala kicks in first. So it takes 12 milliseconds for the amygdala to trigger. And for reference, the blink of an eye takes about 300 milliseconds. So it kicks in fast. Now, the prefrontal cortex, this is the logic-centered part of our brain. And unfortunately for us, this part of our brain actually takes 40 milliseconds or a little bit more than three times as long to trigger as the amygdala's response. So this means that however rational we're trying to be, our amygdala is always going to be framing or potentially clouding the prefrontal cortex's ability to do its job properly. So the amygdala triggers first, and it's going to release hormones, and one of the hormones is cortisol. So one of the side effects of cortisol is that it regulates or limits blood flow to the body and the brain. And this is like super helpful in some cases. Like if you're wounded, cortisol literally helps slow that blood flow. And if you're bleeding significantly, it could actually be the difference in you bleeding to death or living. So it's very helpful, especially for a lot of physical things. But what's not helpful is that cortisol also limits that blood flow to the brain, and it can inhibit our mind's ability to perform at its best and make the most rational decisions. So bottom line, for non-physically threatening things, we're actually at a natural disadvantage when it comes to making rational decisions when we're under some form of stress or duress. So if you consider yourself a very calm and calculated person, that's great. But just remember, just know that when things go sideways, even if you think or you feel that you're able to make very good decisions, that it's likely your ability to do that is going to be somewhat inhibited if you're also experiencing fear or stress or some type of duress.
Jason, are there things we could be doing or should know about that can help us with all of this?
Yeah, there are. I'll actually try to touch on a few. The first one would be something called representativeness. So as humans, we tend to be wired to place too much value on what we know or what we think we know or what we feel. And we also tend to place too much value on our own personal experiences and circumstances. Things like our background, our family, the successes or the challenges we faced in life, where we live, our profession, even the company that we work for. These are all examples or potential examples of sources of representativeness. And they can all affect our decision making. And in the case of this conversation, I guess they can affect our investment decision making. So one example of where representativeness can possibly harm us would be like when an investor owns a lot of their employer stock as part of their retirement plan. So first, let's think about why someone would own a lot of their employer stock in that retirement plan. So the company we work for, it's familiar. Typically, corporate leadership is often going to present a rosy picture of the firm's outlook. And when the company does well, for sure, corporate leadership is going to remind their employees how well the stock is doing, right? So now, if we own a lot of the company's stock in our retirement plan or 401k plan, now we need to do is look at that ownership of that stock and then couple that with the fact that we're relying on that same company for current income and for future income, as well as a bunch of benefits in some cases and possibly even retiree benefits. So when you combine all those things, you can create a risky and potentially toxic level of financial reliance on the company that you work for. So let me give a real life example. I brought on a client a few years ago who had about $2 million in his 401k plan, and he was getting ready to retire, and 80% of that 401k balance was in employer stock. And the employer stock had done well, and the client did not want to sell the stock. You know, he was getting ready to retire. I had made a recommendation to divest a sizable portion of the stock into other investments, not because I had any idea of what the future was for the stock or that I thought it would do poorly, but just, you know, there was just far too many eggs in that one basket of, you know, the employer stock. Client didn't want to do it. It had done really well, and he had developed an emotional connection to the stock over time. So we went back and forth, and finally, he agreed that he would sell it if it reached a target price of about $10 a share higher than it had been. So basically, we never got to that price because shortly after that, the stock actually went from $120 a share down to $30 a share. So here's the math. He watched his 401k go from $2 million to less than $600,000 over the span of about 3 months. Now, today, that stock is actually trading only around $45 a share. So it's trading about a third of what its value was when I initially made the recommendation to divest. And so in this case, for this gentleman, owning that much in one stock, or in his case, his employer stock, literally had irreparable consequences concerning his retirement and his financial future.
So it sounds like what this person thought or felt to be true got in the actual way of doing the best for themselves.
That's exactly right. His familiarity and his comfort in the stock was the source of the representativeness. And, you know, in that case, the consequences were not good. Here's another example, albeit it's a bit broader. When you think of retirement age, you think of age 65, right? Or around age 65. So that number actually came from the first pension plan that was ever created. It was created in Germany in 1878, and it was intended to pay benefits at the worker's age 65. The thing is, in 1878, the average life expectancy was 47 years old. So fast forward to the 1930s when Social Security rolled out. Social Security also used that same age 65 as the base or the target retirement age. So at that time, the average life expectancy was 61. So today, when we think about retirement, we still land around age 65, right? Maybe a couple years earlier or later, but around there. Meanwhile, life expectancy has increased another 20 years, and yet we're still using the same target age for retirement. And that's totally fine. I always encourage clients to plan and to set a goal to retire or to be at a point where work is optional sooner rather than later, right? But if we have a longer life expectancy, but we're using the same retirement age as time goes on, that does put more responsibility on us to save more money for retirement, especially if you don't have a material pension plan, which less and less of us are now obviously having. It puts more responsibility on us to save for what's likely going to be a lengthy retirement, you know, especially if you're going to plan on exiting the workforce around age 65.
And we're back with Jason Betts. It is kind of crazy that the normal retirement age comes from such a long time ago. Are there like other tendencies we should be aware of?
Sure. Let's see. Recency bias would be another. So we're wired to feel like whatever has happened to us recently is what's going to happen in the future. And by recently, I don't mean in the last day or months or even in the last year. Generally, it's going to be whatever's happened over a multi-year trend is going to wire us to think that that's kind of what's going to happen now moving forward forever. For example, and I'm kind of dating myself with this one, but at the end of the bull market of the 1990s, most investors, and really financial professionals as well, expected and assumed the market's rate of return was going to be 15 to 20% per year moving forward pretty much forever. And that's because that's what we had experienced for the prior 9 years. So in early 2000, what we had experienced came to an abrupt end. The market went on to crash, and it took almost 7 years to recover from its previous highs. Now, conversely, after the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, most investors that were asked what they expected to make in investment returns felt they would be happy to just make 3 to 4% over time moving forward. And that was just before the most recent 10 to 11 year period where the market value has more than quadrupled from its 2009 lows. So in both of those cases or examples, recent trends had framed investors' thinking and expectations. And if you acted or changed your investment strategy based on those feelings or expectations, the outcome was going to be harmful.
Jason, are there any other things that my listeners might want to be considering or be aware of?
Sure thing. If we have time for one more, I'd say be aware of something I like to call media response. So as investors, with the help of TV and especially the internet over the last 25 years, we have been inundated with information. And much of that information obviously comes from the media. Ever read something in an article and it made you want to make a change with your investments? If so, that means you're human, but it also means you're potentially falling prey to the media's goal of stirring our emotions to keep us engaged. So I like to tell people, please remember this statement. The financial media is not a free financial research tool. They're not in business to hook investors up with the inside scoop. They're in business to sell advertising and to keep you interested. They do an excellent job of appealing to our emotions in how they cover events and how they cover investment outlook. And they do it and they keep us engaged and keep us clicking or watching. So they mainly use two techniques. Both of the techniques are going to involve fear, scaring us, but in different ways. Generally, they're either going to want to scare us into the fear of losing money, or they want to scare us with fear of missing out on making more money. So the articles and the content are packaged differently, and they have varying degrees of information, but the headlines are almost always laced with hyperbole. So please, again, remember, the financial media is not a free financial research tool.
All right. Well, Jason Betts, the independent private wealth advisor for Ameriprise Financial, I want to thank you so much for calling in. Do you want to add anything before I let you go?
In conclusion, I just say that the term sleep on it isn't just a saying. It's literally a healthy thing to do. When we act quickly under stress is usually a bad move. Historically, the more time we can take to remove ourselves from our emotions, the better financial decisions we're going to make. There are times when that might not totally be possible. So in that case, being aware of our tendencies like representativeness and recency bias and like media response can at least put us at an advantage and increase the probability that we're making smart and wise decisions with our money over the long term.
Great. Thank you so much, Jason.